Welcome to The Riff, where writer and investor Bern Hobart and I discuss the major inflection points caused by technological change. Our weekly conversation covers the obvious and not so obvious ways in which markets and businesses will adapt as a result. Let's jump right in.
We touched on generative AI a bit last week, but I want to go deeper this week based on a piece that you had. You wrote about the continuum between search and generative AI and how this affects platform strategies. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah. So there's this really interesting concept that that I like of generative AI as being like a search engine for the things that hypothetically could exist but don't actually exist. And so you can kind of think of it as on the same continuum as a Google and a TikTok. They're both fundamentally search services. They do a different kind of search. Like TikTok is essentially assembling this implicit, long implicit query based on your behavior within the app. And then they're using that to surface the next video you should watch, which is also going to give them more data on the next thing that you'd want to implicitly search for. And then you've got Google obviously doing that very explicitly, where they originally are trying to match the exact keyword you have to whatever page on the internet is the best fit for that. And then over time, they've gotten a lot more elaborate with trying to actually infer your intent and trying to show you snippets and pull out the information you want and things like that. But it is fundamentally this process where you're mapping what people are looking for to what's already out there, but you can also map what people are looking for to the space between two different things that are out there, and somewhere in between there is the thing that you wanted. That thing doesn't exist just yet, but it can, given a sufficiently powerful model, can come into existence. And once that becomes possible, like it's already happening on the edges with things like inline AI in search, which is just, it's a really fascinating move from Google to me, because it is very much like the fulfillment of the long-term vision of they are finding the information out there that you want. And that doesn't just mean they are treating that information as like this in this set format and that's the only way it exists. It's more that they want the actual information. They're trying to extract it from the medium and just give it directly to the user. So, I think it ties into this idea of AI as this, either like the last user interface or the end of user interfaces, that you don't actually have to care about the form factor that something comes in. You just care about the form factor in which you want it delivered. So if someone, in the future, as AI models get better, if someone is like, I really like cowboy novels and I really like The Riff, so I want an episode of The Riff that is all about my favorite novel about the Old West, then there's enough data from both what The Riff is and from your corpus and my corpus and from the corpus of books about this and from the corpus of podcasts about books and things that, Sora could presumably generate something kind of cool along those lines in not too long. And initially, the quality is just not going to be as good as what a normal human being creates. We're already getting used to detecting, like, what is it that makes an image look like an AI-generated image? There's like something weirdly consistent about the colors that makes it look like digital art, only more so, and you just know it's AI before you even get around to counting people's fingers and looking for where their clothes blur into their skin or whatever. And similarly in text, we sort of know that humans do occasionally call something a rich tapestry, but ChatGPT calls a lot of things a rich tapestry. And it likes to delve into things as well. So like the quality of the content won't be as good, but it will be on exactly the topic that you care about. And that's often enough. So you can analogize this to the ChatGPT use case of coding, which is probably the most economically valuable thing that I get from it, is just, I want Python code that does this. And then it gives me Python code that does that. The style is not going to be that great, but I care less about the style than just does it exist? Does it do roughly what I want it to do? So that creates an interesting situation for companies, because it means that one of their most valuable assets over time becomes the training data they have on both what do users care about and what do users like, what results do users like. So that was originally data that you'd use just to train a better ranking model, but over time it's becoming data that you use to actually create the content itself. And the asymptote for this, which I wrote about long, long ago, well, like 2 years ago at this point, I think, was that in the future, we will probably reach a point where the median audience size for any given piece of media is exactly one person. That you don't need to look for someone else's thing that is close enough to what you wanted. If you want to consume some particular kind of media, you can in the future get exactly what it is that you wanted, which is like all kinds of scary, depending on, you know, what that content is, how good the AIs are at generating it, how compulsive people will be about consuming the exact kind of content they want. Like, you know, people in a wide variety of domains, people go through episodes of just way over consuming some particular kind of thing. You know, binge viewing has been in the discourse for a long time. It turns out that given the opportunity, there are people who will just watch 10 hours straight of Better Call Saul or something. You know, fun show, but probably not something that you should rearrange your schedule around. And certainly in categories like porn or gaming, people can spend a really, really huge chunk of time in, you know, just passively consuming stuff. So it does get kind of worrisome. I suspect that we will end up with some social norms against spending too much of your time just consuming AI generated content. There will probably be social norms in favor of not just reading things that were actually written by a human, not just having person to person interactions, but specifically reading things written by a person before LLMs came out. So you know it's actually by a person. You know that there was some specific person who thought that this was worth writing and wanted to bring it into the world. But there's, I think the general bet in terms of just how the economy develops over time is that we tend, for a while, economic growth just means we get more of what we had. So, you know, the first stage of economic growth is you go from there's enough food to eat unless there's a famine to there is generally enough food to eat. Like, you don't worry about your family starving anytime in the near future. And, you know, you slowly upgrade your needs. But as you upgrade your needs do get more specific. You have this slice of the economy that is positional goods for super rich people. So, you know, there's only going to be one biggest apartment in New York. And there's going to be a bidding war among the people who want to own it. Works of art are N of one, and the value is the value that the next highest bidder ascribes to it, plus whatever the art dealer can get you to pay over that. But for a lot of other goods, like, everyone has a very, very different mix of needs, preferences, things that they will actually go to their way to buy, things that they just wouldn't care enough to buy. So we end up with just a lot more heterogeneity in consumption as people get richer. And in media, if the marginal cost of creating a totally new thing collapses in media first, then that's where you'd see the maximum heterogeneity. And like, media is already probably the case where you just have the maximally weird mix of things that people listen to. Like, I suspect that if you take someone's, you know, if you take Spotify listening histories and, you know, RSS or Twitter click history and, you know, email, I guess email would be weird, but like, if you take those things, take like what shows up in news feeds, it's probably enough to uniquely identify anyone. In fact, it's probably the case that something like if you took like the top three articles that are shown in someone's Facebook news feed, that is likely to just uniquely identify them among all the people on earth. So we're already at the case where media consumption is extremely fragmented and extremely heterogeneous, but it's going to get more so over time.
It was interesting. Josh Miller, the CEO of Browser, had this interesting thread where he talked about how AI really puts killer apps sort of up for grabs, or makes it look killer apps up for grabs. And he talks about how incumbents want to have this narrative that data is the new oil, or because data is the new moat, because that's in their incentive to do so, because it keeps the user faces the same and does and just plays around with the data. Whereas startups like Arc and what they're trying to do with Browser are trying to create a wedge into, you know, a potential dominant user face, but that AI really kind of resets the puzzle, so to speak, of what's possible.
Yeah, I think typically new interfaces do just cause a lot of resets. They create either a completely new market or realistically like a new way to sell some existing product. And it does change who gets share. And this is more visible in media because you do have zero marginal cost for distribution. You have the fact that any given piece of content could be either something you charge for or something you give away for free as an ad, or something that you give away for free in order to display ads on it. So, it just media tends to spread fast, grow fast, and tends to illustrate a lot about slower moving markets. And yeah, it is true that what happens early on when there's a new way, a new model of distribution, is that the people who master that distribution model, they win first. But eventually it's the people who actually have better content who win in the end. So there was this time where BuzzFeed was eating the New York Times' lunch, and there was this big internal memo at the Times where one of the things they pointed out was they wrote an article. I forget what it was. It might have been their accents thing, but probably not. They wrote some article that was like a viral hit to them. And then BuzzFeed just rewrote little bits of that article, and it was massively bigger as a viral hit to BuzzFeed. And the Times realized, like, we just can't afford to be in the business of creating free raw material for other people to run better ad businesses on. So they decided to focus more on actually making things viral, on actually controlling that a little bit better. And it worked. And then it turns out that if you pit the BuzzFeed newsroom against the New York Times newsroom, and they both know about the same amount about how the Facebook algorithm works or how Google search rankings work, like, New York Times is going to win. They may have the wrong cost structure or something, but yeah, on average, the people with better content do win. And you can see this with like visual entertainment, where early on, part of what Netflix took advantage of was just media companies did not understand how big streaming would get. I think anyone could sort of look at the rise of broadband to residential households, but you could extrapolate it, but it would have felt extremely weird. You'd be asking the question of like, why isn't a 66K modem good enough for everybody? Like, why do people need insanely fast internet? Why are they all going to upgrade? Won't this top out at some point? But it turns out, no. People tend to just like things to get faster and faster over time. And so early on, Netflix could win just by buying the rights to large libraries from other studios and just being the first to put that content on an easily accessible streaming format. But eventually they realized that they had to actually have good content too. And now it's kind of, you know, it's tough to say. I guess it becomes a very qualitative judgment. And also, I just don't know that it's humanly possible to watch the entire content library for Netflix and HBO Max and Paramount Plus and all that and actually have some definitive judgment on which one has better content. But the content still matters a lot for Netflix. And then it never quite equilibrates, because now there is like, part of the bet for Netflix is just their scale is so vast and their ability to target is so good that there is very little streaming content that is worth more to somebody else than it's worth to Netflix. And that's always a really good position to be in. Like, if there is some very broad category of assets and you know that you can get more, you can produce more of value out of those assets than anybody else who could own them, then you have a lot of wealth creation ahead of you. And, you know, people who are valuing Netflix stock, they're valuing it accordingly.
We'll get back to the conversation in a moment after a word from our sponsors. Hey everyone, Eric here. At Turpentine, we're building the first media outlet for tech people by tech people. We're the network behind the show you're listening to right now. We have a slate of hit shows across a range of topics and industries, from our AI and investing cluster of podcasts to shows that drive the conversation in tech with the most interesting thinkers, founders, investors, and influencers, like Econ 102 with Noah Smith. We're launching new shows every week, and we're looking for industry-leading sponsors. If you think that might be you and your company, email me at ericaturpentine.co. That's E-R-I-K at turpentine.co, and let's partner together. The tech world turns to the Brave browser for its unbeatable privacy protections. But did you know that Brave also has a private ad platform? Brave Ads offers first-party targeting, and it's been cookie-less since day one, so you can relax while third-party tracking cookies disappear from the web. Today, millions of people turn to ad blockers to avoid being tracked and pestered online. But Brave's new ad model aligns incentives for users and advertisers. Users earn rewards for viewing ads, which they can save, spend, or pass along to their favorite creators. And advertisers score points for respecting user privacy, generating ROI without invasive tracking. So whether it's high-impact announcements on the new tab page or keyword-targeted ads in Brave Search, Brave offers diverse, private, future-proof ad formats for all your business goals. Join the future of advertising at brave.com/ads. Mention MOZ when signing up for a 25% discount on your first campaign.
Well said. Let's segue to something else you wrote about, Austin's housing market and why that's interesting for housing markets more broadly.
Yeah. So in the interest of full disclosure, I do have a long position in Austin housing. I bought at the peak, but because of the mortgage system, like, it, I think I think economically, I'm still ahead that my mortgage has lost value faster than the house has lost value, although neither market actually clears. So it is kind of irrelevant, but, you know, worth potentially noting. So yeah, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal earlier last week about Austin's housing market. And the basic story was a lot of people moved to Austin during the pandemic. A lot of houses got built in Austin as people were moving in. Eventually, some people moved out and the price of housing dropped in Austin more than anywhere else. And what struck me about that article is, like, it shouldn't be news. It certainly should not be national news that the price of some product went down when demand was below what people estimated when supply came on. And housing, it's a very long duration asset. You know, you build a house and it probably gets knocked down 60 years or so in the future. So anytime the supply is that sticky, like it lasts for 60 years, and the demand can fluctuate in shorter periods than that. Like Austin's labor market is different from what it was in 2019, very different from what it was, say, in 2009 or in 1999. So you have more volatility on the supply side on the demand side than the supply side. And that will always be the case. So it is just naturally true that housing prices at the level of local markets, like they naturally fluctuate. Now, if you don't actually experience that fluctuation, if it is just not the case that, you know, when the NASDAQ is down 30%, that housing in the Bay Area is also down 30% or something, it doesn't mean the volatility has gone away. It means somebody else is experiencing that volatility. It's just not experienced in a visible way. And my suspicion is that the actual group who end up being the shock absorbers for the intrinsic unpredictability of housing demand over long periods, those are people who want to move into houses and who can't do it yet. So you can generally keep housing prices high if you restrict supply when there's an influx of demand. And then if you have a financial system that encourages people to borrow and that allows them to refinance when rates go down, you do tend to give homeowners a sort of put option on their house, where even if their house does nominally lose value, the fact that they have a mortgage where, let's say, you know, it's the year 2000, someone got a mortgage at 7%, they refinance at, you know, 5%, so they suddenly have more spending money. So even though their house has gone down in value, they're actually economically just fine. But that all for that to work, you need interest rates to be very responsive to the macro situation. And that sort of means that when there is a recession in the US, we basically redistribute money to people who borrowed money to buy houses. And we hope that they spend enough that that money gets redistributed to people who did not own houses, who tend to have less money and tend to also be living closer to paycheck to paycheck. So like we do have a kind of weird system. It's good for homeowners. Homeowners do tend to vote more than other groups. So it's probably a pretty politically durable system. But it would be nice to have a system where in any given city, if there is a huge increase in demand, you see a lot of construction. If that increase in demand was temporary, doesn't materialize, there are some empty houses, but houses got built and there can be a cohort of people who wanted to live in that city. They couldn't afford it. The city got cheaper and what they liked about the city was still there. So they're able to move in. And this is kind of, you know, this is sort of the story of how neighborhoods turn around sometimes, is that like there's a recession and, you know, some particular neighborhood, the bottom falls out for property prices. A bunch of people move in. They are kind of like, they're, you know, people who are trendier and, you know, are not maximizing their economic output, but they are making the neighborhood a cooler place to be. So think of like neighborhoods gentrifying in Brooklyn, where it starts out as just like no one would want to live there. And then you find people where they do want to live in New York and they're not especially picky about where they go. So they go to the cheapest neighborhood they can find that's still convenient for the city. And, you know, 20 years ago, that was Williamsburg and rents started escalating. But it used to be like a kind of counter signal thing to move there. And then it became very much a signal thing and then became like this post signal thing where it is basically, you know, an extension of Manhattan, but people are trying to be hipsters, but it's barely working. They sort of have to be, Manhattan conformist enough to actually afford to live in the burg. And so it loses the vibe that actually made it that kind of neighborhood in the first place. But like that kind of thing, it can happen when you have just high variance within a city and, you know, high variance from neighborhood to neighborhood. And when city services are not necessarily that great. So there can be just much worse places to live, but in a better functioning city, you basically don't have that kind of engine for neighborhood turnover. And so things just end up a little more static than they should be. So, you know, I think in totally like purely selfish terms, it would have been awesome if Austin had just like rezoned everything as single family only. And also you can't build anything here ever, you know, as soon as the ink was dry on that home purchase. But I think in terms of actually running a functioning city, like, yeah, it's, and you know, I think it's just not a huge deal for the world if there are some property developers who are running into liquidity problems. Like, it's a naturally speculative job. It should be the kind of thing where sometimes you make a ton of money and sometimes you lose a ton of money, and it should select for the kinds of people who want those economics. There are plenty of more stable jobs out there. But it's, you can't really get rid of the intrinsic instability of a house lasts for a really long time, but you can't move it. So you're stuck with it in either a great place to own a house or a terrible place to own a house. Like, it's still a house. Someone bought it. It's on somebody's balance sheet. That's going to be true no matter what. And I think that we should, like, it's a bad sign if that is not visible in housing prices. So I think Austin is leading the way.
That's exciting. Are you bullish or bearish on sort of the approaches of companies trying to fractionalize real estate ownership as a way of boosting liquidity?
It's hard to do. It is just really, really hard to underwrite the value of a house. And a lot of our mortgage system is based on this idea that there should be like, you know, a light amount of underwriting, but just not mortgage lending outside of the jumbo category is, you know, somewhat credit sensitive, but not as credit sensitive as it really should be. If you have a like totally free market mortgage system, which is what the U.S. Mostly free market mortgage system is what the U.S. had pre-Great Depression, your typical mortgage was you put 50% down and then you have a 5-year mortgage with a balloon payment at the end. Like that was pretty much how you could finance a home purchase if you intended to borrow money. And housing was a lot cheaper then, so it isn't like you'd be buying. It isn't like the price to income ratio in the 1920s was what it is today, but it was still just not an especially enticing financial deal. And one of the obstacles in trying to make mortgages more widely available was just, it's really hard to know which house is worth lending against. And we have better data on that than we used to, but I would say that one piece of evidence that this is really hard is Zillow tried to do a home flipping business because Opendoor was doing a home flipping business and doing it really well. And Opendoor was underwriting based on tons and tons of data that just had not been widely available until pretty much the post-crisis period. They also had the advantage that within cities that had been heavily developed in the run-up to the financial crisis, you had a lot of very standardized housing units that were still pretty similar to one another because they'd been built around the same time. There just hadn't been enough time for people to add a new deck or, you know, redo some part of the house. So you actually had a lot of pretty clean data. And then you had pricing data from, here's when someone bought this new house in Phoenix in 2005. Here's where it sold for when they got foreclosed on in 2008. And then, you know, here's where it ended up when the private equity firm that bought it eventually sold it to a regular homeowner. So you actually had a lot of pricing data points that you could use to build some more robust economic models. And so when iBuying started, they were basically running the housing, like the history of housing bubbles in reverse, because that's always where they had the richest data. So, you know, starting out in the Sand States and then moving to like Sun Belt and then going broader than that. But it's still hard. Like they, Opendoor ran into some serious problems. They had a lot of inventory that was hard to sell, and housing prices turned faster than they were able to react to. And kind of the entire environment around selling houses to institutions versus individuals changed. So given how hard it is to do that when you actually have the benefit of taking basically a spread on the transaction because you're providing convenience, I suspect that it's going to be even harder to sell equity in individual houses to individual investors. I think there's going to be a lot of adverse selection there. Like if you think about it just from a maximally cynical perspective, suppose there are two people, they live in identical houses. These houses are both, you know, were both bought for $300K. One of them thinks this house is actually, one of them knows their house has been improved a lot and is actually worth $400. One of them thinks the house is actually kind of deteriorating. There's a lot of mold, et cetera. It's probably worth $200. Like, who is going to sell equity at that $300K price point? It's obviously the person whose house is worth more than that, they have no incentive to sell. The person whose house is worth less than that, they have a very strong economic incentive to sell. It's unethical. I guess it kind of depends on the market. Like you can definitely have a caveat emptor view of like, it's a house. You could literally drive past that house. You can see what kind of neighborhood it is. You can look at all these records, but there isn't information asymmetry. It's going to benefit people who would want to sell equity in a house that looks better on paper than it actually is. So I think that is roughly the portfolio that you would select into if you bought that. So it kind of depends on really how honorable people choose to be. And also it might depend on when they make the purchase and when they sell the equity. So if you did this alongside someone buying the house, so let's say instead of you have your 10% down payment and then you borrow 90%. What if it's like 5% down payment, you sell another 20% of the equity, and then you only need to borrow 75%. And you are, I don't know, somehow providing a return to those equity holders, either through paying them some kind of rent or through giving them a piece of the capital appreciation, but it has to be a pretty big piece. It has to be more than their equity stake because they're foregoing the rent. You could see something like that work out because the outside investor is coming in at the same time as the inside investor. It's sort of like participating in a round when you really respect whoever's leading it. Like you just kind of assume that all of the things, like all the due diligence questions you're worried about, they have checked those off the list. Their due diligence list is longer than yours and has even better questions that you didn't even think of. So, you know, you can feel like it's kind of safe. But even in that case, like I'm also just not sure how much it changes the economics for the home buyer. Because again, you need, if you invest in someone like American Homes for Rent, so they own portfolios of single family residences, they're charging rent and they're paying a dividend. So you are actually getting this carried, like you're getting positive carry on this, where you're getting income, and then the assets that are providing that income are also slowly appreciating on average over time. So if I buy equity in your house, does that mean you're paying me some rent? And if so, do we calculate that rent using like the imputed rent calculation from the CPI? Do we use some other calculation? Do we use like Zillow's number? Or is that rent going to be pegged to the mortgage? In which case it is just a different way to describe a mortgage. Maybe the paperwork is different. Maybe the tax situation is different, but it's fundamentally close to that. I could see something like that potentially being interesting, but I think from a cash flow perspective, it's just hard to make a big difference. And if you make the cash flow more favorable, so I buy equity in your house, I don't get any rent or anything. The only way for that to be a good deal for me is if the capital appreciation I get compensates for the rent I wasn't getting. And so maybe instead of like a 4% rental yield on this property, maybe I need like a 5% return on top, like an extra 5% return on top of whatever capital appreciation you get. And then you can have this really dark situation where people do a bunch of these deals. They're really happy about them. They totally forget about it. Like they ostensibly know, but they're not thinking constantly that they only own part of this house. And then they sell the house. They realize that the preference structure means that instead of getting a lot of money back as they pay down their mortgage, like they're actually getting just their down payment back or something, because the terms were stacked in such a way that the outside investors did really well at their expense. Like it's just fundamentally hard to deal with the fact that housing costs, median housing price is a multiple of median income, but people don't want to work for a really long time, save up enough money to buy a house for cash, and only then buy a house. Like people want to live in homes that they in some sense own pretty early, especially if they want to form a family. And you can do a little financial engineering to make that easier, but if the supply of housing is restricted, then that financial engineering ends up meaning that you have better financing options. As a result, the market clearing price for a house goes up. So, anything that is like a subsidy to first-time home buyers, that subsidy gets captured by people who sell their homes to first-time home buyers because the market just can't adjust fast enough, except in Austin.
That makes sense. Let's segue into talking about the false positives in data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was thinking about like sometimes an investment process or just a decision-making process is kind of, you're thinking, you're mulling, you're playing around with abstractions in your head, and then you get an idea and then you maybe do some research, maybe just execute. But in a lot of cases, the place that ideas come from is looking at the data, looking at it in a lot of different ways, doing a scatter plot, doing different charts, looking at trends, trying to understand what's driving these numbers and where they come from and where they might potentially be going. And what happens a lot of the time is the more data driven your process is, and the more data you have, and the more competitive the market you're in is, the more likely it is that any interesting result is just a spurious correlation. It is just noise in the data, or it's something that that looks like a signal to you, but that is actually what you should expect from just whatever process leads to that data. So you can think of this in terms of, let's say someone is running a food delivery app and they notice that customers who order extra appetizers tend to have higher lifetime value. And so they decide they want more of that. Like maybe our ad shouldn't show burritos. They should show salsa and chips. They should show something that is, you know, snackier, so we get more of those snack prone people. But then you might find out from running that expensive new ad campaign that actually the causation works in a different way. It's that there are higher and lower spending customers. The higher spending customers are more likely to order appetizers, but you can't actually recruit them just by selling them appetizers. Like they're just higher spending people who have to be reached through some other means. You see this a lot in data-driven investing. So it is increasingly affordable to just download tons of market data and start looking for correlations and find just totally meaningless cases where two stocks happen to correlate really strongly. And sometimes there's an actual reason. Like you do want to stress test the assumption that these correlations are likely to be spurious by asking, what is a reason that they would not be? Is there some common factor that drives both of these that is not a factor on the general roster of factors people care about? In fact, there was a piece I wrote a while ago that was riffing on a podcast from the Twitter Anon Macrocephalopod, who talked about how momentum, when people are using basically principal component analysis to explain market returns. So, you know, like stocks went up 1%, so you expect the average company stock to be up 1%, but oil stocks were only up 0.5%, but this particular oil company was actually up 4%. Like if you run a bunch of those regressions, one signal that actually pops out as predictive of future returns is momentum. And this always drives people kind of crazy from both an efficient markets perspective and a value perspective, because from an efficient markets perspective, buying things that went up in order to sell them for an even higher price, that should not work. From a value perspective, it should also not work. But it does actually statistically, on average, over long periods of time, it does work. When I say it works, it's like you add like 1 point of extra return, but you also have massive drawdowns from time to time, but it's still better on a risk-adjusted basis than just buy and hold. Anyway, one way of thinking of that is that there is some factor that's driving multiple companies at once, and that when you run your principal component analysis and find that there are these clusters of companies that outperform or underperform, that often there is some factor that's driving both of those. So the example I think I gave back in the day was if you're running your analysis and you notice that the two big outlier categories in February of 2020 are, hey, cruise ships are really underperforming, but also Zoom and teleworking companies are really outperforming. There was a common factor there, but your model probably did not have a pandemic feature in it. So you look at that, you realize that if that feature is not in your model, it's probably missing from a lot of other models. As people add it to their models, they adjust by buying Zoom and shorting cruise lines. So if you add it first, you win. And you can even do that agnostically. You can say, like, I have no idea why these stocks rise and fall together so closely, but there's probably something causing it. And I'm just going to bet that that thing will continue and will be discovered by other people. So, you know, momentum, like it is a case where you're basically mining the data in order to figure out what's missing from your model. And I think that is actually the fundamental thing you're doing when you have some kind of data-driven research process. You're trying to say, if you had a perfectly good theory about the world, then no data point would ever surprise you. So any data point that surprises you is either telling you that the world is different, like the world is changing, or your model has some kind of deficiency. And figuring out the actual border between those two is always really tough. Like anyone can overfit, and people do it all the time. I do it all the time. Just like I notice this weird idiosyncratic data point. I can come up with a story for why it makes sense, and I'm going to believe that story forever, even though the next 10 data points all refute that story thoroughly. It's very hard to avoid that, but if you do that consistently and rigorously, you do start to develop just a much more fine-grained model of not just here's the state of the world, here's my mental model of the world, but also what is the process by which I get the data that I have. So sometimes when people are using, like, let's say someone's doing web scraping and they find some weird anomaly where their web scraper indicates that this company should be doing, like, you know, much more in revenue than it's actually doing, and they don't understand, or this company's doing much less in revenue than that. Like, it doesn't look like the company is producing much revenue compared to what their financial statements say. Like, sometimes the deficiency in your model is either that company's being scammed or that company is a scam. And this actually, so a fun, like, tying some of these together, it was a fun situation with the iBuyers a couple years ago, where there was a data provider who was scraping home listings to track iBuyer activity, and they were selling this data to hedge funds. And, you know, this is a fun and noble profession. I've done this kind of thing before. It's great. And they sent out a note to their clients one time and said that they were actually withdrawing their estimates because their open door numbers looked fine, but their Zillow numbers had gone so low that they knew there was just something wrong with their scraper. Like, it was inconceivable that Zillow's, you know, home purchases per week had dropped by like 99% or something. And then a couple of days later, Zillow came out and said, we've actually decided to exit the iBuying business. So they had correctly identified this, that this number did not actually make sense. But the reason the number did not make sense was that there was this change in the state of the actual world such that the number was just way off from what it had been before. So I think this is just like, it's a rewarding process, but it's also a very dreary process, because you know that if you download a bunch of data and start running regressions and try to look for some signal, and the signal looks like exactly what you were looking for, like, here's an amazing opportunity for me to grow, you know, grow TripAdvisor's revenue 10% without much effort by changing a few words on a landing page, or here is a stock that I'm pretty sure is going to double because of this data point that is finally inflecting in the right direction. Like, most of the time, you're just wrong. Most of the time, it's a fake correlation. And the more exciting the potential outcome is, the more likely it is to be totally wrong. So you do sort of have to develop a thick skin about these things. And you have to really get in the habit of never telling anyone you're excited if they're going to want to use whatever the final product is, because the more excited you are, the more likely the final product is just, you know, the null hypothesis once again holds, and the data was not telling me what I thought it was. But if you do it enough, yeah, you really understand where your data comes from, what you're measuring, what you're missing. And then you start to develop a pretty good mental model of who is making the decisions that create this data. So if you're tracking a lot of, say, credit card transaction data from a company, and you start to notice some change in basket size, like people are doing smaller orders but more frequently, well, that tells you something interesting about the company strategy. Maybe it tells you there's something changing about their cost structure. Maybe it tells you that there's something new about their marketing. Or maybe it tells you they are cutting costs, like they're cutting prices, they're competing on price more, customers are responding by buying more, but even if revenue keeps growing, margins will get crushed. So never, never a dull moment if you are trying to use data to understand anything whatsoever about the world.
Yeah. Let's segue into Apple and everything that's going on with antitrust and how that affects the underlying business.
Yeah. Yeah. So the antitrust case against Apple, it's kind of tricky because they do a bunch of anti-competitive stuff, but it's so hard to call them a monopoly unless you define, and this is what the government did. They basically defined this new category of the market that is high-end smartphones such that Apple has a monopoly in that market. But like, you can do that with a lot of other markets. Like if you define high-end dining well enough, you can set a threshold such that only one restaurant in a given location actually passes that threshold. And then they are by definition a monopolist. And I'm sure if you look at the margins of whatever restaurant in Manhattan or San Francisco or Paris or London has the highest highest revenue per diner, probably their margins are also pretty good. Usually that's how it shakes out. But I think it's not enough to just say we can back into a definition of the market where they do dominate that market, and then everything they do is the thing that a monopolist does. You do have to ask, like, is that a meaningful way to talk about the market? And I don't know that it is. I think a lot of people, they will consider Android, they will consider Apple, and Apple definitely does not go out of its way to make it easy to switch to a different ecosystem. So things like, you know, the blue text bubbles are probably, you know, $100 billion of market cap for Apple, something like that, because they do raise the switching cost. The fact that iMessage can be tracked on your phone and your watch and on your computer, also really, really valuable. But those are also really valuable to users, like being able to have these things that are tightly integrated across an ecosystem of devices and services that are all all vetted by the same company, like that has non-zero value. You do actually know that these things just work. And the more open the ecosystem is, the more it is kind of tricky to figure out, like, will this random Android smartwatch that I bought from whoever's selling the cheapest smartwatches on Amazon at the moment, like, will this actually be compatible with the things I care about? Or is this basically a slightly marked up version of a digital watch I could have bought in the 80s? So there's like a, you know, business strategy case for a lot of what Apple does, but then the way that they capture a lot of the long-term upside from their entire ecosystem is they create this environment where it's very doable to create a third-party app that uses Apple's ecosystem, uses their user base, and can spread very fast within that group. And then you sort of end up with two categories of apps. There are the things where people use the app for a while, then they get bored of it. Or I guess you could say three. Okay. We've got cases where people use the app for a while, they get bored of it, and they move on to something else. So like games. There have been good game companies. It's just not a great business, not a business that Apple is just begging to get into in a big way. So Apple is fine with that being a third party. Then you have businesses where the product is good, everyone ends up using it, but it's hard to replicate without some external investment. So, you know, for Apple to build an Amazon killer, they need to build the entire logistics network. For Apple to do a Spotify killer, they had to do a lot of deals with music companies and, you know, had to get exclusives and things just to outrun the fact that Spotify has so much more distribution. For Netflix, similarly, like in a lot of these cases, Apple has made an effort to replicate some subset of what the other company does, but it doesn't seem like they've actually decided that, okay, your second best music app will be Spotify, but you will actually if you're a true music lover, you will switch to the Apple ecosystem specifically to access Apple Music. I don't think they've made an investment in music or in movies that accords with that. And they are really good with logistics, but they also, like, one of the reasons that they can be so good with logistics is that they have such a short list of products. And you walk into an Apple store, you look around, you see everything that Apple sells, and it's a whole lot easier to manage inventory if you don't have very many SKUs. But Amazon has a lot of SKUs. I think most of them are Kindle singles, but like Amazon has a lot of actual real world SKUs. And if they're going to do 2-day shipping, they have to have a lot of warehouses and a lot of places that have these products on the shelves, ready to go, well-tracked, et cetera. So those are two categories. One, you know, not worth copying because it's just not a great business. Two, not worth copying because it's really expensive. You have to build a whole business just to copy an app. And then the third category is things where it is like, self-contained within the app and it's useful and everybody loves it. And in that case, Apple's incentive is, if we don't actually need to do that much to replicate the business, why don't we make this an in-house app? Why don't we in fact make this an app that automatically installs on people's phones? Why don't we make it really trivial to upgrade this app? Maybe we'll add it to a bundle of other apps. And that does kind of freak people out. And this is something the government, like, their complaint gets adjacent to this because they talked about how Apple makes it hard to run a super app. And I thought Stratechery actually made a good point on this, which is just the American app market doesn't seem to like super apps that much. And it's not as if when you move to Android, suddenly you are on the WeChat or the Caspi of the US. No, like, we tend to, for whatever reason, prefer mostly single purpose apps. In fact, even companies that could have a super app, they often break the app into multiple parts. So Amazon has an Amazon app. They have a Kindle app that's separate from the Amazon app. They have the Prime Video app that's separate from that. Presumably music is a separate app too. So like even the companies that could offer a super app because they offer a super app level of like suite of services, they do tend to have special purpose apps. So I think this is less something where you can say, hey, Apple made it so that nobody can run a super app in the US, and more say that, no, Apple is just very fortunate that the phone is closer to being the super app, and that's where the competition for this fully generalizable tool that also owns all your data, that's where it happens, is at the phone and account level rather than at the level of a specific app. And of course, that should worry any kind of antitrust investigator or whatever. Like, they should worry, like, even if it is a totally organic phenomenon, it's a phenomenon that makes apps, that makes the phone business much more monopolistic in a US context than it otherwise would be. So they are right to be concerned about that. But then you sort of have to ask, like, where like you have to kind of pick your poison, because it sort of feels like the concern is, you know, Tim Cook has too much power and Sundar has too much power and Mark Zuckerberg has too much power and so on. And so we need to stop this and put Lina Khan in charge of all of those companies. And so, like, you know, it's not like she's making every single product decision for these companies, but giving regulators more veto power doesn't really disperse overall power in the economy. It concentrates it even more. And switching costs from Apple to Android or from Google to DuckDuckGo, they are non-trivial, but they're a whole lot lower than the switching cost of getting out of the US and not being controlled by the US. Like, you know, if you want to leave, that's expensive. And also your friends mostly stay. If you want to leave for tax reasons, well, you're going to be paying American taxes for a very, very long time. If you want to leave because there's something that America thinks should be illegal and you think you should be entitled to do it, they do sometimes, like, depending on the thing, they will arrest people who did something that was legal in one place and illegal in the US if they are American citizens. So, and, like, you know, most of the time that's actually, like, stuff that, you know, I'm glad that that people don't get away with it. But it does mean that you don't really have an opt out. You have more of an opt out actually within these quasi monopolistic platforms than you do with the regulators. So there is kind of like, there's like a values question, which is just really frustratingly hard to answer. And I could see plausible answers going either way. Like, I could see some people saying, no, I actually strongly prefer that someone have veto power over Tim Cook and Mark Zuckerberg. And, you know, I do trust them less. I do trust the big tech execs less than I trust regulators. And other people will make another argument. But I think it's inevitable that if we have a category of businesses that have these really powerful network effects, that there are places within those businesses where it's winner take most or winner take all. And it's just going to be a persistent problem for a long time. In fact, if anything, I would expect it to get worse over time. I would expect that the power law distribution gets even more skewed. You have even bigger winners in new categories, and that it's even harder to figure out exactly how much power they should have, and if it is even conceivable to break them up in a way that doesn't destroy a lot of consumer surplus.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see the workarounds that other companies like Microsoft are doing.
So I don't buy the story that Microsoft did an asset purchase of Inflection specifically to avoid antitrust. Like, what it reminds me of is Elliot Spitzer. He wrote a bunch of rules on banks reporting suspicious transactions, and then he also wanted to send a wire transfer to the madam who procured prostitutes for him. And so he did send a transfer, and then he asked his bank to remove his name from the transfer and remove all references to his account information from the transfer. And I think his thinking was, well, the rule is we flag these transfers based on who did them. But it turns out that the banks internally have another rule, which is like, it is, you know, a triple red flag if someone is aware of these rules and is explicitly trying to work around them. So, you know, it's sort of like if you happen to be wandering around in some random neighborhood and, you know, the cops pull you over and ask, like, the cops pull over and they say, hey, what are you doing here? It's a lot harder to be innocent if you're also, like, wearing a ski mask and you have, you know, your lock picking kit with you and your flashlight and things. Like, once you've made it very clear that what you are doing is specifically trying to evade rules that are in place for a good reason, they tend to take that pretty seriously. So I don't actually think that is what was going on with Microsoft. I'm actually not entirely sure what was. It might be some kind of face-saving thing where you had a subset of people, either employees and investors, who did believe in part of what Inflection was doing, and then a larger set of people who did not and just wanted a quick exit, felt like the space is getting too competitive and the product's not working as well as some competitors are, and it's better to be a small piece of Microsoft and own a small piece of Microsoft than to continue doing this thing. So I think it was a weird deal. Perhaps something will come to light that someone is trying to do something weird here. But I also, like, just internally, it would be really hard to execute a transaction where the actual goal is don't, like, find some technicality where the FTC and DOJ can't actually stop us from doing this, because we know they definitely would stop us otherwise. Like, if that's the goal, like, how do you prevent anyone in the legal department from ever emailing and saying, hey, why don't we just acquire them? And if someone does email that, like, what do you say back to them? You know, if in discovery, it turns out there's an email from Satya and he says, never say that over email, please check my Signal chat, you know, my Signal message to you, I will explain everything. That's pretty bad. And, you know, if you get a bunch of people together in a conference room, you're like, hey, we're doing this secret deal, do not say anything about this over email, but here's what we're doing and here's why. Well, you need to trust that the person in that room who will be the least loyal at some point in the future will never reach the point where they would rather blow the whistle than stay quiet. It's tough to pull off a conspiracy like that. And, you know, Microsoft's security posture has always been, or has not always been, their recent security posture has been assume that the hackers have already breached the system and, you know, build your security around that assumption. And I suspect that has been their attitude with respect to legal stuff since the 90s is like, when you write an email about Microsoft strategy, mentally just, you know, BCC, the scariest lawyer you can think of at the DOJ, because they will read your email. And the cooler your email is, the more likely they are to read it out loud in court to you. And you will probably think that your jokes were much less funny in that context than they were in this email, or that, like, your desire to crush the competition reads very differently once the competition's actually been crushed and, you know, once the company's bigger, et cetera. So, like, yeah, I don't buy that theory, but it is a confusing deal.
Makes sense. Let's segue to your piece on Duolingo. What did you think was particularly interesting about their ad product placement?
Yeah, so the thing that got my attention on Duolingo was the stock is up, and it is above where it was in the 2021 peak. And I was running through my list of, like, all the reasons you should expect Duolingo to be down 90% since then. Like, okay, it's a 2021 vintage IPO. It is a company where they have an app, so, you know, great for people stuck indoors and bored. It's a growth company. They have pretty generous perks. So one of the Glassdoor reviews that I read said you get no one's working the last week of the year or last 2 weeks of the year. And also there's a company funded work free retreat once a year. Like, that's all pretty expensive stuff. Duolingo is also this bet on globalization. It's this bet that people who know one language will want to know another language. And that's a bet that makes a lot more sense if people can do business across national borders, can travel across national borders, etc. So yeah, zillions of reasons to think that Duolingo should be dying, or at least should have materially lost a material amount of valuation, but it's actually up. And, you know, exploring that, I learned a couple things, one of which was that, a lot of what I think actually worked really well for Duolingo was they did stop spending as much on ads. There was a while where their ad spending was escalating pretty fast. It was actually, you know, reasonably low, and they are a sufficiently viral product that they didn't need to spend a ton on ads. They do talk a good game about being product first and not really focus on marketing, and they do actually seem to live that out. But when I was looking at some of the ads, so they'd mentioned in their conference calls the ads that they'd run. And so they mentioned they got a ton of impressions for their Super Bowl ad. And I was just curious about what they would show for their Super Bowl ad. And so I Googled it, and it's literally a 6-second video where a cartoon, like the Duolingo owl, farts out a different owl. And then it just tells you to use Duolingo, which is extremely surreal. But what I realized was, like, if you are watching the Super Bowl, you know, in a mixed group, let's say it's, you know, your family is doing a Super Bowl party, like, either the older people in the room are like, what was that? I have no idea what's going on. Or even better, they're like, wait, is that farting owl ad for the same Duolingo that you talk about with that cartoon owl? Explain yourself. And so it was basically a way to force the Zoomers to explain to the Boomers what Duolingo is, why it's great, why they love it. And they have to explain it in this kind of defensive way, because it's not just a surreal ad, but it's not just like a mysterious ad. It's like an actively surreal, confusing ad if you don't know what the product is. And then they did something similar with Barbie, where they have product placement in Barbie. I watched the Barbie movie, excellent film, and did not notice the Duolingo product placement, because it's literally this, I think it's like a 2-second cut. Like, it cuts to this 2 seconds of a guy using the app. You can see his face, so you can't actually see what's on his phone, but you do hear a ding and you hear that he's practicing Spanish. And I think that's another case where you actually get more leverage from the ad if it is a vague enough ad that people are explaining it, but the people who like the product are actively interested in explaining what it does. So Duolingo was basically taking this huge audience that they have of very addicted daily users and using them as a marketing force, but then not just saying, hey, we're going to throw up our hands and we're just going to assume that word of mouth will somehow rescue us from not having to think about marketing. No, it was, we're going to actually use marketing specifically in ways that activate word of mouth. And that's often by slightly embarrassing our users such that the only way they can recover from this slight embarrassment is to strongly endorse our product. And ideally to say like, yes, the farting owl is a very stupid and confusing ad, but here, try Duolingo. Like, you've always said that you wish you knew French and that you'd never practiced since you took it in high school. Here is your chance. You will learn some French. You will tell me merci when you're done. So I thought that was pretty boring. And they also, or not boring, brilliant. Brilliant. So the other thing that they talked about was family plans, which I think is actually kind of adjacent to that media strategy. And the thing with family plans, I think this, the pricing is like, for one user, it's $7 a month. For a family plan, it's $10 a month. So in the event that people are trading down from two single user plans to one family plan, that's bad. But group plans will tend to have lower churn because you just need one person using the app. And then the other area where they've been growing really fast is in-app purchases, where they have an internal in-game currency. You can use that currency to freeze your winning streak. And they use all these little behavioral tricks like winning streaks to encourage people to use the app every day, get a little practice in every day, which does actually work for language learning. But they also, I think, realize that the longer your streak of using the app is, the more daunting it is to start a new streak. So if they give people a way to make a very nominal payment in order to keep that streak alive, that is one more source of revenue. It's also one more source of continuing engagement, and it's one more source of sunk cost. So people do feel like they put a lot of time into the app and they put some money into the app. And so it would be a really, really dumb decision to throw away their, 3-year streak of daily Duolingo practice, some of which was a streak that they earned, some of which was a streak they paid for, but to throw that away just because someone else in the family doesn't want to keep using the app, because they, I don't know, finally took their Paris vacation, so they don't need to learn French anymore. It will feel like kind of a waste, kind of a sunk cost, so they won't do it. So I thought it was an interesting company to look at as like a survivor, as a company that is actually helping a lot of people to at least get partially up to speed on foreign languages. And also just as a demonstration that the problem of how do you actually package your product, how do you pitch your product, and then how do you charge for it? Like that's never actually solved. And there will always be some new tweak you can do. But to actually make those tweaks work, you have to have a really good understanding of what your users are doing, what role the app plays in their lives, what role, like what their relationship is to people who could hypothetically use the app, but don't yet. You have a lot of unknown unknowns, and then you have some known unknowns that you can actually A/B test your way out of. So if you have this combination of sometimes you just do some, you have some totally new way of thinking about how the product is sold or how it's paid for, and then that actually gives you the raw material for doing a lot of A/B tests to figure out, okay, once we have the family plan, what is the best variant on that family plan that actually keeps people subscribed a little bit longer?
One thing we haven't yet said too much about, but you've written about it, is and we can close with it, is the Reddit IPO. Do you want to share your quick thoughts there? One thing that I thought was interesting was their sort of the business model around sort of interacting with AI or using their data, for AI. That's kind of, maybe that'll be more common elsewhere, but I thought that was intriguing.
Yeah, I did think that was interesting. And I think, and I guess it goes back to our earlier discussion on generative AI and search and training data, where Reddit is a really interesting source of training data. And one way to think about it is that they are able to aggregate these really, really narrow slices of demand for certain kinds of information and able to get people to supply that information in a way where if you made it a purely economic transaction, if you said, I am going to find someone who, I don't know, knows a lot about Austin lawn care and has really strong opinions on the best lawnmower, I'm going to somehow find this person and I'm going to pay them like 20 cents to tell me what the best choice is. Like, you end up spending many orders of magnitude more finding this person, explaining the deal to them, and then getting them to do it. Whereas if they're just on Reddit and they see a question that they know the answer to, they will answer it. At least they have a decent chance of answering it. So Reddit's actually able to surface this long tail content that otherwise just would not exist in a computer readable form. It exists on a lot of brains. A lot of people know the stuff that's on Reddit. I mean, somebody had to know it for them to write it, but it didn't exist in a format that was easy to find. And it is like, it's been a trope for years now that if you want an honest product review, you search for the name of the product and then add Reddit. So I think the fact that it is a social interaction and that's the reward, it's not a monetary reward for most Reddit users, does change in a positive way how people answer questions, how thorough they are, how honest they are, et cetera. So it does make it a unique, valuable source of data. And then to me, the perennial problem with Reddit has been that more so than many other sites, although not as much so. Some sites, like the median user seems to be like a militant Reddit hater who also spends a lot of time on Reddit. It is tough to make decisions on behalf of a large number of people. In general, the decision is going to be salient to the people who don't like it. It's less salient to the people who think it's obvious. And so the debates will tend to be pretty polarized, but mostly very negative. And Reddit's had that struggle for a long time, but the users are the people who actually make the site really valuable. And Reddit did acknowledge that nicely in their IPO by actually allocating a ton of stock to Reddit power users. And I think it was Matt Levine pointed out that, yeah, they priced it in a way where the stock would get a pop, because the last thing you want to do is get, you know, tens of thousands of users to each invest in your company and then have them lose money that they can't necessarily afford to lose. So I think they did a good job of actually basically giving their users a last minute stock-based comp grant. Like, the usual way you do it is, when the company is prepping for an IPO, you set up the senior executives with pretty generous stock-based comp. And, you know, sometimes that leads to some wild numbers, like first quarter out, they recognize a bunch of stock-based comp costs and numbers look kind of crazy. But yeah, Reddit did a nice version of that, where they actually allocated a bunch of capital to people who will now have not just the sunk cost of all the time they've invested in Reddit and the friendships they have with other people on Reddit, but also that they are part owners of this enterprise and it's made them money. So it's one more reason not to quit. It is actually just like the Amazon strategy of, you know, when in doubt, add some random new thing to Prime, because that's one more reason someone might not churn. So Reddit is doing that at a small scale in a very different direction, but they're doing it. And, you know, given, let's see, stock seems to be up. Okay, it's at 60. That's nice. So yeah, it seems to be working really nicely for them. I did note, by the way, when I did my Reddit IPO write-up, that they are not going out of their way to prevent it from being a meme stock. They have nice things to say about Wall Street Bets. And like, I wouldn't want to say anything too mean about Wall Street Bets. There are just a lot of them. They're very high energy people. And, you know, they do believe in some conspiracy theories about Citadel and things that I do not actually agree with, but I do think their hearts are in the right place. And you know, it's a fun community. A fun but negative expected value community. Anyhow, so like they could have just omitted that, or, you know, alluded to it. They said it pretty directly that they thought this was kind of cool. So I do think that there's going to be it'll be a while before it's actually a good use of anybody's time to do a discounted cash flow analysis of Reddit and figure out what the company is actually worth. Like, for now, it's a fun stock for people to trade. There are a lot of people having a blast, I'm sure, trading it. I was actually briefly worried that there would be this sort of inverse Wall Street Bets thing where all the Reddit people who are on Reddit but also hate Reddit management, or like they love Reddit the product, they hate Reddit Incorporated, that they would all short it, and then you'd actually have hedge funds engineering a short squeeze and finally soaking all of the apes with their diamond hands in this, you know, wonderful but extremely uncomfortable comeuppance where finally the billionaires get their revenge on the middle class. But no, it didn't happen that way, at least not yet. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it is actually squeezing right now. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, that's a great place to wrap. Bern, as always, great conversation. Until next week.
Yes, indeed. This was fun. All right.
Thanks for listening to The Riff. Please go follow and subscribe. Give us 5 stars. And check out Bern's excellent newsletter, The Diff, if you haven't already.